Welcome to Focus on the Upstate, a program dedicated to informing you about organizations that serve our community and how you can get involved with them. Here's your host, Chris Evans.
Good morning and welcome to Focus on the Upstate, a pre-recorded production of Entercom Communications. My name is Chris Evans and this is episode 35 of the COVID Chronicles. Today, my guest is Lieutenant Alex Long of the Simpsonville Fire Department. Good morning, Alex.
Good morning. How are you?
I'm doing well, sir. And yourself?
I'm doing pretty good. It's a pretty day outside today.
So. They're all pretty days here in South Carolina, aren't they?
Yeah, most of the time.
Pretty much all the time. Although, you know, as a fire department employee, I imagine that you've seen your fair share of not-so-pretty days if you ever have to respond to a real emergency. We're going to talk about that in just a minute, but I want to start with the question that I normally ask. It may seem a little obtuse to ask a fire department what they do and who they do it for, but I gather, you know, people think, well, they show up and put out fires, but that's not all you guys do. So I'm gonna go ahead and pose the question and let you launch into it. What do you do and who do you do it for at the Simpsonville Fire Department?
We pretty much are jacks of all trades. We don't just, like you said, fight fires and that's it. We run medical calls. We run traffic accidents, hazmat calls, rope rescues. Basically, almost anything anybody can call 911 for that they don't have a direction whether it should go to law enforcement or EMS. The fire department's probably going to catch that, and we have to be well-versed in just about every subject under the sun, to be honest.
Fill in the gaps, so to speak.
Yep.
You know, it's interesting because you think about calling 911. Obviously, there's an emergency going on if you're doing that, and if you're doing it correctly. Some people call 911 over chicken McNuggets, and that's not appropriate. Let's just state for the record. But if you wind up needing to call 911, you almost expect that the police are going to be the ones that take every call and show up for everything. But really, like you said, the fire department goes to any number of incidents where you wouldn't even see a fire, much less have the potential of one.
That's correct. Well, I mean, it could be anything down from a tree in a roadway to I've worked or volunteered at some other departments that, you know, have responded to a loose cow or something, you know. that might not be an emergency in some places, but
sure,
depending on where it is.
If you own the cow...
Right. So just kind of depends on the incident.
Well, and you mentioned medical service, that a lot of the firefighters are trained as EMTs, and or at least you have EMTs on the staff there. And I've seen a number of, say, traffic accidents where there's a fire truck out there that's responded to the accident, and it's not necessarily because the cars were on fire or there was even a risk of the cars being on fire, but it's because somebody needed medical attention.
That's correct. A lot of times in traffic accidents, you know, there are injuries. So we provide basic life support or first aid for those incidences. And then once those accidents actually clear, where the EMS actually transports those patients, sometimes we will still remain on scene to assist law enforcement with traffic and stuff like that. So when you see us on accidents and stuff like that, we have the road blocked or something. Don't get
aggravated. Yeah, it's hard to miss a fire truck.
Yeah, don't get aggravated with that, because that's just we have those placed in a way to keep us safe, law enforcement safe, the record driver safe, and we have them positioned in those ways to keep us safe because people don't like to pay attention and or get over or slow down. So
that's how the accident happened in the first place.
Right. Right.
Now, this occurred to me as I was preparing for this interview. When I first reached out, and we should make the point, you're with the Simpsonville Fire Department, and most fire departments around here have a particular locality or municipality that they work for. It's not like there is a state agency. Talk about that for a second.
So basically, the counties kind of work together. Your local departments kind of work together, you know, kind of like neighbors helping neighbors. And then it goes to the county, and then it goes to the state level. So there is something called the Firefighter Mobilization Act. And so, for instance, when there's hurricanes or natural disasters, there are urban search and rescue teams as well as regular fire departments. And basically, they kind of get deployed to those incidences. Also, there's been times too where other departments might have a line of duty death or something like that, and the state fire Academy will kind of like send something out with the Mobilization Act and get folks in line so they can have the people that are suffering might get to have their stations covered by other departments that might not actually be there. So, for instance, let's just say it could be in Columbia. Well, you might have somebody from Greenville City Fire Department or Rock Hill Fire Department or Myrtle Beach Fire Department covering that area just for the time being, or for a deployment of a natural disaster, you might have guys from the upstate, you know, riding trucks in the lower part of the state. So it's basically, as far as the brotherhood of the fire service, we're going to try to do everything we can to help anybody within the state.
But I gotcha.
Your district's going to be who you serve, your community that pays your taxes directly, or their taxes directly, is going to be firsthand, because that's going to be your everyday customer.
Gotcha. Well, as I said, as I was preparing for this interview, it occurred to me as I was reaching out to people at the Simpsonville Fire Department to invite somebody on the program, I wound up talking to the fire chief and the fire marshal, and I think that was the first time I realized that those weren't necessarily the same kind of position. I think I may have used those terms interchangeably before, and it occurs to me now that they aren't necessarily interchangeable. Talk about the difference between a fire chief and a fire marshal.
The fire chief is going to be the head of the actual organization.
So the CEO, kind of.
Basically, he's going to run the whole corporation or the whole company. Under him is going to have a different level of managers. A lot of times municipal or bigger municipal fire departments are going to have divisions. So for us at Simpsonville, we have the fire chief's over everything, and then there's basically three divisions. There's operations, which is your everyday guys on the truck running calls, and then there's a training division, and then there is the fire marshal's division. So in Simpsonville, I believe there's like between 1,000 and 1,200 businesses. So instead of having firefighters go out and do inspections, you have the fire marshals and the deputy fire marshals actually go do those business inspections, make sure they're under code and they're doing everything properly to keep the citizens as well as the firefighters safe. Now, in some smaller departments in different places in the state, the fire marshal and the fire chief can be the same person.
Gotcha. Well, thank you for clearing that up, because I was curious about that mm-hmm. and realized that that was not something that I was aware of. And then you mentioned the code enforcement. That's part of fire prevention and fire safety, is making sure that buildings are built and occupied in such a way that we don't have a hazard and avoid creating an unnecessary emergency situation.
That's correct. So all the codes that are basically in place for building or for fire protection, the reason that they're there, just like warning labels on a lawnmower, is there's been somebody that's done that. So throughout history, as far as buildings and stuff like that, massive fires, for instance, like in Chicago,
right,
or big theater fires, big fires in New York, have basically set those codes, some of them, and they're not just the United States codes, they're the international fire codes. So fires throughout the world have basically dictated these codes to help folks build buildings safer and, prevent a massive loss of life or property.
One of the things I like to do in interviews like this is kind of do a virtual walkthrough of the home and stop in each room and look at what might be fire hazards in each particular room. Let's start in the bedroom where people sleep. I remember being a kid and there was a campaign about smoking while you were sleeping, or falling asleep while you were smoking, or something like that, and that was how fires start. How common is that, especially these days? It seems like smoking has kind of become less popular.
Yeah, I feel like that might be a little bit outdated as far as that goes. I remember my dad, he told me when him and my mom were young, they had a guy in their apartment complex that caught the apartment complex on fire smoking. If you look at statistics nationally, what's going to really be the number one cause of fires is going to be in the kitchen. It's going to be cooking. So, I mean, that's where your most used source of heat's going to be.
Right.
People have accidents there. But as far as like the bedroom, the biggest thing about the bedroom is just knowing your way out in case there is a fire. Something that's really big that the fire service is trying to push now is sleeping with your doors closed. The reason that is they've actually been doing studies where they're setting buildings on fire, and then they're putting thermal cameras in there, you know, thermometers, seeing what all the temperatures are, all this stuff, and then they'll have one house with the doors open, and then they'll have one house with the doors shut, and the amount of destruction that is in a home that the doors are open is, I mean, it's basically the fire just ravages all the way through the home, versus if you have your doors shut, it really does give you a lot of survivable time. For instance, let's say you were on the second division and you didn't have an escape ladder, which they sell at Home Depot or Lowe's and stuff like that. But if you didn't have that, you know, it will give you time to bang on the windows, open the windows up, bang on the windows, you know, get our attention, and hopefully we can get you out instead of having to go through the entire building that's on fire. But sleeping with your doors closed is a giant safety point that the fire service is trying to push right now.
Well, that's a good tip. Let's talk about the bathroom, for example. What sorts of fire hazards exist in bathrooms?
I would say it's more safety hazards, period.
Fair enough.
So, you know, obvious things like, you know, don't fill your sink up with water and then put your curling iron or your blow dryer in there,
right.
Drop it in there. Electrical hazards are big. The big deal is make sure if you are using a curling iron or something like that, and when you're done, don't set a towel or a paper towel or something on it. Make sure that it's unplugged. Unplug those things and then kind of like set them in the middle of your vanity or something like that, where it's not around anything. It's not going to touch anything directly. So while it is cooling off, it's not going to hopefully create any problems. And for older homes, if you don't have a ground fault outlet, see if you can get some ground fault outlets installed. That way, in case you were to have an accident, you drop something in the water or something like that, it's going to flip the breaker and it's going to cut the power to that, and hopefully not cause any problems to where you would get injured.
Yeah, that's a relatively simple and inexpensive upgrade, is to just replace the electrical outlets with those ground fault circuit interrupt, I believe is what that stands for, GFCI. Mm-hmm. And yeah, it's like a built-in breaker into the outlet rather than it having to travel all the way back to the breaker box that's in your garage or something.
That's correct. Anywhere where there's water, that's a great thing to do, including outside outlets.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. I also know that dryers can be a fire hazard.
Outside of cooking, dryer fires are probably one of the other top leading causes of fires within the household. The big deal is make sure that you clean your dryer vent every time you use it. You don't
want to
leave.
Not just the one in the dryer, but you need to pay attention to the exhaust vent, too.
Yep. So eventually, you know, at least I would say once a year, you need to pull your dryer out, take everything behind there, you know, clean all the any of the lint that could be in the back. And then also, you can either get a company to do it, or I believe they sell like snakes and stuff like that to go through and clean that duct out to make sure all of that extra lint works. Just to give you an idea of how flammable lint is, I actually keep my lint. I get my lint out of the dryer, I put it in a Ziploc bag, and I keep that. And when my family and I, we have like campfires or we go camping, I use that as the fire starter. And you only have to have the spark on there, and it's,
yeah,
you know, whoosh, it's up there. So it's really dangerous. And then the other problem with that is because that fire is going to go through walls and then it's going to be hidden. So it makes it a little bit more difficult for us to find and take care of when we get on scene.
Gotcha. Well, you mentioned it a couple times already, but let's talk about the kitchen explicitly. Obviously cooking, you know, having a range or a stove or something like that, you're dealing with very high temperatures, and it's easy for a towel or something to fall into the wrong place and catch on fire, or even food to become overcooked and cause a fire.
This is where I think we see probably the most, especially living in the South. You know, we've got folks that are cooking some French fries or something like that, and then they spill some grease and they're using a gas stove or spill it directly on the implement, and then they just it catches fire. The big deal is if there is a fire on your stove, you do not want to use water, especially a grease fire.
Right.
You do not want to use water. That will do nothing but spread that fire and make it flare up. And also, we can go into the deal where if there is a fire in your home, everybody needs to get out of that,
yes,
that structure. And the best thing, once you get out, is you need to pick something called a meeting place. That meeting place could be a big tree in the front yard, your neighbor's house, the mailbox, wherever. But basically, once the fire alarms go off or there's a fire in your home, everybody's out, everybody meets at that meeting place, and basically you take role just like when you're in school and you had a fire drill. Everybody goes out there, and it's a good idea to do something called an exit drill in the home. And basically, especially if you have kids, they do fire drills at school. You should still do fire drills at home too. Those kids need to know two ways out. They need to know the meeting place. They need to know do not go back in the house. They need to know, you know, when the firefighters get there, you know, they need to say, hey, my mom's still there. Where's her bedroom? Well, her bedroom's in that corner of the house. That's her window.
Right.
Things like that. And then, but we need to practice those at home with
Indeed.
Our children.
Let's, and the point about grease fires is don't use water. Make sure that you smother them with something. They need to be covered rather than dump something on them to put them out. Let's move on to the living room, because that's where people are going to start fires in fireplaces and have their Christmas trees up and things like that.
This year, or this time of year, is kind of crazy because we take a living tree and we cut it down and we put it in our house. So it's a great tradition. It's fun. Everybody enjoys that. But there's really some things that you need to think about when you're picking out a Christmas tree, especially a live Christmas tree. You know, everybody watches the Christmas Story on TNT or whatever when it comes out, and you
right.
know Ralphie's dad shaking the tree, and or the guy selling it, he's like, there's no needles falling off of this, and all the needles fall
yeah.
off of it. The reason that's significant really is because when you shake it and there's needles fall everywhere, that means that tree's dried out.
Yes.
So from a fire safety standpoint, when you pick your tree, you know, you want to kind of shake it. If you're cutting it down straight off, like you go to somebody's tree farm and you cut it down, you're not going to have that problem. But if you're buying it off a lot, you want to shake it a little bit, see if there's any needles that come off. And then you want to make sure that that tree is watered very well, because it only takes like 1 to 3 days of not watering your Christmas tree well. And if there is any type of spark or ignition source on a Christmas tree, I mean, it will go up like a match. It will just light off.
I gotcha. You mentioned a couple of times preventatives and safety measures, things like fire extinguishers, smoke detectors, carbon monoxide detectors, mm-hmm. things like that. What do people need to pay attention to as far as preventing a fire and dealing with it once it does start?
If you have, like, say, candles or any ignition sources close to things, you want to make sure that other things that could catch on fire is not close to it. So candles, you want to make sure, my wife likes burning candles. You want to make sure those are out of the reach of kids, and you want to make sure that there's basically a 12-inch clearance from those things. Same now, people are getting into space heaters because it's getting cold. You want at least a 3-foot clearance around those space heaters so the radiant heat is not catching anything else. It's a fairly high percentage of Christmas tree fires actually are started because they're too close. They're dried out, so people aren't watering them. But then on top of that, they're too close to space heaters. And
which is just going to dry them out more, if nothing else.
Right, right. So it's just going to dry them out even more, and then the radiant heat actually just ends up catching them on fire. So, you know, you want to make sure you don't set stuff on a hot stove. Especially, I always get it, like I have a glass-top stove at home, and I think people have a really bad habit of, because it's a glass top, they set things on it. Well, that's just a bad habit to be. Try not to put anything on a glass top stove, whether it's on or off. But as far as your smoke detectors, Fire Safety Month is in October. That's usually when you'll see fire departments push, hey, check your batteries, hey, check your smoke detectors. I say you should check them twice a year. Try to check them every time the clocks change.
The clocks change, yeah, daylight
yep.
savings.
Check to make sure that they go off, you know, press the test button. And then if you ever hear them in the middle of the night and they're like, beep, that means they just like kind of chirp every
yeah.
5 or 10 minutes.
Need a new battery.
Battery dead. Yep.
Takes
so
a 9
go
volt.
Ahead, Yep. So if you go ahead and you check your batteries twice a year, you should never run into that problem, hopefully. But when you do check them, turn them over. There's a manufacturing date on those things. If they're over 10 years old, then you need to replace them.
Then
they're
need to be replaced. And I understand that the new ones actually have long life batteries in them. They have like a lithium ion battery that'll last the entire life of the smoke detector.
Yep. So I guess you could go off your manufacturer's recommendations for those. They'll have, you know, the instructions, but still make sure that you check those things twice a year. But after they're 10 years old, the problem is you could press the test button and it still worked, but the little electrode or the photo sensor that actually detects the dust or the smoke, it might not work.
Just wears out.
Yep. Carbon monoxide alarms, especially if you have any type of gas or propane appliance within your home, or you're running a space heater, those things are going to alarm around 35 parts per million. The meters that the fire department uses, they like that we use, we have one that detects CO, and it alarms for us at 35 parts per million. And once that hits, if it's going off, you'll be seeing us wearing our air packs and stuff like that to be safe. So if you have some folks that have a fireplace or something like that, and they don't have that clean, and there's a obstruction within the chimney, or the flue's not open, the smoke can fill the home and then cause CO. Or if there's a gas leak, that can cause CO. We'll see a lot of times folks that are heating their house with a generator, whether it's an emergency situation, or if you're a lower income folks that can't afford certain things, and you're running a generator, don't run it under the deck. Don't run it under a crawl space. Don't run it in the house, because it's going to end up finding a hole.
Yeah.
It's going to fill the house up, and those things emit like 400 and 1,000 parts per million of CO, and it only takes 800 parts per million exposure in like an hour to kill someone.
Yeah.
So they can be really dangerous. And then it kind of sounds crazy, but I promise you, if you have if you look at the news, you're going to see somebody within the United States use a charcoal grill to heat a home, and that CO is going to get them. So you know, just if you're going to use anything that's going to create CO, you want to make sure that it's going to stay outside in a well-vented area, away from the actual confined area that you're going to be living in, whether it's a camper, a mobile home, or a house.
Well, real quickly, let's talk about some of the outside fires, because I know this is also the time of the year that leaves are dropping off of trees, and a lot of people would burn those. I know in Simpsonville, particularly, I just moved into the Simpsonville city limits, and they have an ordinance about that. And and you're not allowed to do that. But on the other hand, there are plenty of people who have things like fire pits in their backyard. So what makes the difference between a fire that you can have outside and a fire that you can't?
So a lot of municipalities will have ordinances against debris burning or clearing of land, any type of like natural stuff like
trees. And you should check your own locality to make sure that you are in compliance with the law.
That is correct. So Simpsonville, we cover the city limits of Simpsonville, and then we cover a county contract area. So we cover some outside area of the city. Most of the municipalities have that type of area, and that's how they obtain their income through their property taxes. But as far as debris burning, so within the city, you can't burn yard debris, but you can have a recreational fire for warmth. So like if you have a fire pit or a chimney or something like that, you can have that, and your family can sit outside and roast marshmallows. So the state government basically doesn't limit fires basically for cooking and heating purposes. So, and then outside of the city limits of Simpsonville within the county, you can burn yard debris or leaves or things like that. But what we like to do is you do have to call the forestry commission. They have a 1-800 line. You can Google that. Each county has that line. You have to call that to have permission. That call is only good for that day, and then it will say today is a low fire danger or a high fire danger. We don't recommend burning or things like that. So that's a good thing to do. What Simpsonville likes to do is we like to have folks call the forestry number, and then we like them to call our fire department too. That way we kind of got a heads up if, you know, we get a dispatch call and it's in the area of a control burn that was called in, we kind of can say, oh, okay, well, you know, that's over there. It might be something that's not really anything, or we, it can give us the heads up to go ahead and step up because we know something's already there and it's for sure
right.
a problem. But you do have to call forestry. We like you to call us. You're only allowed to burn natural debris. You can't burn
like
shingles or tires or buildings, not without permission of going through DHEC.
Okay.
And that's pretty much the outdoor burning rules. But if you do have that, if you have any questions, call your local fire department. They should be able to answer you. You can call the Forestry Commission. They'll be able to tell you even more rules because they have rules on burning, you know, yard debris. They have rules on burning, clear cutting areas and burning giant piles. They even have rules on burning, like you said, a building. They have rules on burning those things, but the things that are very harmful to the environment, like shingles and asbestos and all that, anything like that has to be removed. And there's a giant process for that.
And again, contact your local fire department to get more details about that. Lieutenant Alex Long with the Simpsonville Fire Department has been my guest today. Thank you very much for being here, Alex. I appreciate you taking the time to talk to us. It's been my pleasure. I'm Chris Evans, and this has been Focus on the Upstate.
You've been listening to Focus on the Upstate with Chris Evans. If you would like more information on today's topic, email Chris at cevans@intercom.com.